This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. A case in Colorado raises new questions about the limits of confidentiality. Lawyers representing an Air Force Academy cadet charged with rape asked the military judge to subpoena the records of the alleged victim's civilian rape counselor. We'll hear more on the ensuing controversy in a few minutes. Here in Washington, two reporters could go to jail if they refuse to name a confidential source who may have told them who leaked the identity of a CIA agent. Gray areas have emerged in cases involving doctors, lawyers, and clergy. And with Watergate so much in the news this past week, what about the limits of executive privilege? What's private and what isn't? Who should be allowed to withhold information and who shouldn't? What happens when state laws come into conflict with federal or military laws? Later in the program, historian John Lundstrom's campaign to revive the reputation of the admiral who won the Battle of Midway. But first, issues of confidentiality. If you've been involved in a case where privilege played a role, or if you're in a profession where the issue of confidentiality comes up, call us with your story. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now is John Hudson, a former Navy Judge Advocate General, now Dean and President of Franklin Pierce Law School, and he's with us from his office at Franklin Pierce Law School in Concord, New Hampshire. It's good of you to be with us today.
Well, thank you, Neil. It's nice to be back.
I understand that you certainly can't comment on the specifics of this case in Colorado, and we're going to be hearing from a lawyer involved in that case, we hope, in a couple of minutes. But broadly speaking, is it within the ambit of a military judge to subpoena the records of a civilian rape counselor?
Sure, that's theoretically an appropriate thing to be doing. I mean, it gets you to the substance of the question, of course, but... courts martial are federal courts. The judges have worldwide jurisdiction, so that is an entirely legal thing to do.
Does military law, like federal law does military law trump state law?
Federal law, military law will trump state law. Yes, it will indeed.
Is that always the case, or are there exceptions?
Well, that's just, in a court-martial scenario, that's essentially always the case because that's the forum in which the issues are being resolved and the law applies. So that occasionally, actually with some frequency, military personnel will be tried in the state court rather than in a court-martial if it is a crime that has both forums have jurisdiction. But once you're in the court-martial, it's a court-martial case.
So in this case, both the defendant and the alleged victim are in the military. If the alleged victim was a civilian, this might end up in Colorado State Court.
It could, indeed.
So,
and that's just essentially a negotiation between the military and the state authorities as to who will take the case.
Civilian law, whether it's the state law, eventually goes to the state Supreme Court, and from there is subject to review by the United States Supreme Court. Of course, federal law is the same thing. Does the military follow that same chain of command? Does everything go eventually to the Supreme Court?
Well, not everything, but there certainly is a chain of command to the United States Supreme Court for court martials. And every year or two, a couple of years, the Supreme Court will take a court martial case, generally on the grounds on issues of jurisdiction, the breadth of the jurisdiction of court martials, which I said now is essentially worldwide.
Yeah, but some Supreme Court decisions, for example, the Texas sodomy law, that's not applied in military justice.
Right. The laws are not. The military has, in many respects, unique sets of laws, which reflect the unique mission of the military to fight and win the nation's wars, so that. Although the military has largely adopted the federal rules of evidence, which is what this case revolves around, the military rules of evidence are close but not precisely the same as the federal rules.
Eventually, there are military appeals courts, and is there a military Supreme Court?
Well, there is. There's the United States Court of Military Appeals, which is subordinate certainly to the United States Supreme Court, but that's the highest military court, and that's a court that is composed of five civilian, very capable judges.
And eventually, are their decisions subject to review by the Secretary of Defense, or is this an entirely independent system?
No, from there, it would go to, their decisions are subject to review by the Supreme Court.
By the Supreme Court.
Yes, sir.
And so under those kinds of rules, the military courts would have jurisdiction over civilians the same way that federal courts do.
They would have jurisdiction over this kind of case with civilian witnesses. They would courts martial do not have jurisdiction over civilians per se, but they can subpoena them as witnesses. They couldn't court martial the civilian under except under very unusual circumstances, generally relating to wartime.
I see. Now, in this case, do you think we're looking at a showdown between a civilian court? I mean, if the lawyer for this rape counselor continues to pursue the case, there's every reason to believe she will, are we looking at a showdown between civilian and military courts?
It's a very interesting possibility and happens practically never, but it's a possibility that the civilian federal system will say, well, we've got jurisdiction over this, and you could end up with the court-martial system and the civilian federal system butting heads. What's happened in the past is that almost always somebody blinks before you get to that point.
And something settled, or
something is settled.
Subpoenas are withdrawn, or
right,
whatever.
Exactly. You reach some sort of compromise that's acceptable to everybody.
Do you remember a case like this?
No, I don't. And this law is relatively new. The military rules of evidence were amended in 1999 to provide a psychotherapist patient privilege, so that the military has the privilege. It's just that there are, as in most state jurisdictions, there are exceptions to that privilege, and there's a constitutional right to a fair trial, so that the judge could look at the information in camera, you know, out of the eyesight of everybody else, and say, "Gee, we can't have a fair trial of this accused, who, remember, is presumed to be innocent, without this information." You know, say, for example, the victim said, "Well, you know, we were both pretty drunk, and I didn't want him to do it, but I don't remember if I actually said that to him, or I don't know if there was penetration or not," or, you know, something like that. You know, the judge could look at that and say, "Wow, you know, this goes significantly towards innocence." So the balance, on one hand, of the right to privacy of the victim against, on the other hand, the constitutional right to a fair trial could tip in favor of the accused, which the defendant, military refers to as the accused.
Okay, John Hudson, thank you very much. We appreciate your time.
Well, glad to do it. Thank you, Neil.
John Hudson is a former Navy Judge Advocate General, dean now at the Franklin Pierce Law School in Concord, New Hampshire, and we thank him for joining us. Joining us now is Wendy Murphy. She's the attorney for Jennifer Bear, the rape counselor in this case. She joins us from Las Vegas, Nevada, where she's attending the Law and Society Conference. Very good of you to be with us today.
Nice to be here.
Remind us, what is your client's role in this case?
Well, my client provided post-incident trauma counseling for the victim and in the aftermath of the crime, and did so in her capacity as a civilian psychotherapist. She's a licensed psychotherapist in the state of Colorado, and the counseling that she provided is protected by not only Colorado state law, but the military privilege known as Rule 513. They have a relatively new privilege, and none of the exceptions, by the way, apply. I did hear your previous guest. And it's also protected, and I think people don't remember that.
I have to hasten to say apply in your opinion, but go ahead.
Well, no, but I mean, none of the explicit exceptions really apply, but I also want to add that a right to privacy in therapeutic counseling communications is constitutionally protected, and the federal courts are pretty clear about this, that it is under the sort of penumbral rights that we think of as privacy rights, crystal clear, you have a constitutional right to privacy in your therapeutic counseling communication. So when you talk about the nature of the competition, you have to remember the victim has constitutional interest here. And frankly, your prior guest was absolutely wrong in characterizing the defendant's fair trial rights as having any role here whatsoever. And I say that not because defendants don't have fair trial rights. They certainly do. But they are trial rights. Mm-hmm. They are not pretrial discovery rights. There's no such thing as a constitutional right to pretrial discovery as far as the Bill of Rights goes, or any kind of, and this goes for the state system, the federal system, and the military system. So he was just wrong on that. So we have a non-constitutionally based request on the part of the accused, who, by the way, is charged with raping two different women on two different occasions,
mm-hmm.
balanced against the constitutionally protected rights of the victim. And, you know, we're talking about a fundamental right to heal. We're talking about records that wouldn't even exist had she not been traumatized by the crime. So I just want to recharacterize the nature of the contest.
I understand. And the alleged victim, Jessica Brakey, spoke with other counselors. Have their records been subpoenaed? Did they give them up?
Well, interesting point. A large number of subpoenas was issued by the court before I became involved in the case. And I can't say whether they're counselors or not, but I know that a large number of subpoenas went out. And unfortunately, all except for my client sent their entire files in, which is really unconscionable, not to mention unethical. I just can't appreciate at all why people do that, because the military subpoena that was issued in the first instance was clearly unlawful on its face, and they should have done their ethical duty to refuse to comply and ensure that proper legal standards have been met. And had they appreciated that this was not a trial subpoena to protect the defendant's fair trial rights, had they appreciated it at the time, they wouldn't have sent their stuff in. And so Jennifer was the only one who said, this is not ethical, this is not lawful, I won't do it. And unfortunately, because the judge got hundreds of pages of stuff to which the defendant was not entitled, and then he reviewed it privately or in camera,
mm-hmm.
He then sent hundreds of pages of those documents unredacted to the defendant and the rapist. I mean, that's part of the problem here, is that you can think about this as having the protective level of in-camera review, and why is the victim so upset? It's only the judge who looks at it at the first instance. First of all, the judge is the government, so we need to be concerned whenever the government, and even in the form of a judge, and especially a judge in the military, is snooping through private therapy records. But when this judge demonstrates that he has no interest in redacting anything or sending only important evidence along to the defense, then you can bet that Jennifer Beer is particularly concerned about participating in any of this sort of kangaroo court style of justice this judge is doling out.
Wendy Murphy, stay with us for a moment. We have to take a short break. When we can return, we'll continue talking about the issue of confidentiality, not just in rape counseling cases, that's what we're talking about now, but more broadly as these issues come up in other areas. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. Back after the break, it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Lots of professions involve confidentiality. Doctors protect medical records. Lawyers have attorney-client privilege. Journalists maintain anonymous sources. When those promises of confidentiality run into trouble, the law can get involved. Today we're talking about the legal and ethical aspects of confidentiality. Of course, you're invited to join us. If you've ever promised someone professional confidentiality and had trouble maintaining it, should the law offer any protection to protect professional confidentiality? Our number is 800-989-8255, and our email address is totn@npr.org. We're speaking with Wendy Murphy. She's the attorney for Jennifer Beer, who is a rape counselor in Colorado. Her records have been subpoenaed by a military judge in a case involving allegations of rape against a cadet at the Air Force Academy. And Wendy Murphy, you were telling us just before the break that some other counselors with whom the alleged victim spoke had submitted their records. I wonder, does their compliance with military subpoenas weaken your case?
Well, it's a good question. I can't even say that they're necessarily counselors, because I asked the judge to give me access to everything relevant to my client's subpoena, including information about what other subpoenas had gone out and whether the information that had been shared with the court would influence the judge's decision with regard to my client. And the judge refused to give me any of that information. He wouldn't give me access to anything. So I don't know the answer. I can only tell you that if a judge takes a large pile of records in camera and just hands all of the stuff over to the accused, hundreds of pages of stuff, whether it's medical, counseling, or, and the defendant has requested these kind of records, by the way, gynecological records, if that stuff's just being turned over to the accused without even a proffer, you know, that's unconscionable, that's uncivilized, it's clearly unlawful. The defendant didn't even say, I believe X, Y, and Z evidence exists in these particular records. He filed a form motion saying, I want everything under the sun, and the judge said, you can have it.
Well, you haven't seen those records, have you?
I haven't seen the record.
So they may be absolutely relevant. The judge may be right. You don't know that.
That's not the point. The point is you can't put the cart before the horse. I mean, imagine saying to the New York Times in a case like this that judge orders disclosure of a confidential informant. The New York Times says, we're not going to turn that over unless you at least tell us why it's important in the case. And the judge says, well, I don't know yet. Let me just see first, and then I'll let you know. You can't put the cart before the horse because you're intruding on constitutionally protected private space. There has to be a justification for it, and you have to turn over only that small nugget of information that is truly essential to the case. And as I said, Neil, you can't even do that until the trial.
Wendy Murphy, thanks very much for being with us.
You bet.
Wendy Murphy, the attorney for Jennifer Beer. She teaches a course. She, Wendy Murphy, not Jennifer Beer, teaches a course on sexual violence at the New England School of Law and joined us from a conference on the law and society that's being held in Las Vegas, Nevada. And joining us now is Jeffrey Rosen, associate professor at George Washington University of Law School, legal affairs editor at the New Republic. And as with so many questions, we turn to him often on these legal issues. Jeffrey Rosen, nice to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Very nice to be here.
I wonder if you listen to the discussions of the Beer case, the issue of confidentiality is important, isn't it?
It's tremendously important, and as you've been discussing, it connects not only the Beer case, but the discussion about journalists and sources, from Deep Throat to Matt Miller, to important questions about abortion records. It's just a fascinating discussion to be having right now.
Would she be protected in a civilian court?
You know, it's a complicated intersection of privileges. Wendy Murphy was right that in 1996, the Supreme Court recognized a common law privilege, not a constitutional privilege, of therapist-patient confidentiality, but that was recognized in a civil context, and the question of what kind of privileges you have in criminal trials, and as you were discussing, when that privilege applies, apply before the trial begins in pretrial discovery or at the trial itself, is one that is worked out in the lower courts. And when you throw into the mix the fact that this is a military regulation, it just suggests that the law is a little bit unsettled.
Yeah. Could a precedent be set here?
I suppose so. And I gather the part of the case that many people are finding most troubling isn't the subpoena itself, but the fact that the therapist was actually jailed for refusing to turn over the records. That, I gather, is something that no one can think of a precedent for, and generally prosecutors and judges will try to reach some kind of accommodation rather than taking such a dramatic step in a case involving a sensitive balance of privacy rights.
Let's move on to some other stories where privileged communication or supposedly privileged communication has become an issue. Planned Parenthood in Indiana has been ordered to turn over medical records of its patients under 14. The state is looking into possible cases of sexual abuse. Planned Parenthood says the order violates the privacy of the doctor-patient relationship. Do they have a case?
They may. They certainly have some good arguments. They say that if you're concerned about figuring out whether underage women were involved, you could subpoena the birth certificates rather than the medical records. And similar negotiation was involved in the challenge to the federal partial birth abortion law. The Justice Department asked for medical records of people who had abortions in order to figure out whether late-term abortions were medically necessary. And a judge on March 5th of last year actually said that the information was irrelevant, that it wasn't central enough to the trial to justify the invasion of privacy rights. So that suggests that there is often a balance where judges will balance the relevance or necessity of the information against the invasion of privacy, and that balance may be played out in Kansas City as well.
Let's get some listeners involved in the conversation. Again, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255. Lenore is with us from Alexandria, Virginia.
I just wanted to make the point that there's more than just the two sides in the case that should be taken into consideration by the judge when making a decision about whether it's all right for a therapist or a professional who has confidentiality to break it, and that is the future effect, the chilling effect that it would have on future clients. I mean, I'm thinking about this woman who has come to a counselor because she's experienced a trauma. I mean, I'm a psychologist, and the very first question people ask when they come in is, what's the confidentiality? What can you tell? What can't you tell? Before anybody can relax enough to be able to discuss what's going wrong, they need to know what the limits of confidentiality are. And I'm sure what this, you know, what this therapist told her is, we have privilege. I'm a therapist. I don't have to reveal any of this. And only the court can do it in the case of a trial. So this person relaxed and let that go. And if they open up these people's records, how is it going to be for future trauma or rape or any kind of people to come and say, well, I thought you said you couldn't open my records. I mean, the chilling effect that it will have on the future therapy of other people should also be taken into consideration.
Jeffrey Rosen, we don't know who told what to who, but certainly the person may have had an implicit understanding of confidentiality.
Absolutely. It's a central and important point. Indeed, that's precisely the point that the Supreme Court recognized when, in 1996, it said that there is a therapist-patient privilege. It said effective psychotherapy depends upon an atmosphere of confidence and trust, and therefore the mere possibility of disclosure of confidential communications may impede development of the relationship necessary for successful treatment. So it's precisely that logic, the idea that if people's expectation of privacy is violated, that they won't make the disclosures in the first place, that's led courts to recognize not only a therapist-patient privilege, but also in limited context, a marital privilege, a priest-penitent privilege, an attorney-client privilege, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. And that has been extended not just to rape counselors, also psychotherapists, but to situations like Alcoholics Anonymous. Those kinds of meetings are held to be private.
Absolutely right, because of precisely the same reasoning that it's important to foster these kind of disclosures because they're useful therapeutically, and therefore society has an interest in making sure that they take place.
Uh-huh. And Lenore, by the way, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate it. The military law apparently says that this military judge seems to be saying these records are vital for a fair prosecution.
He is, and as Wendy Murphy was arguing quite vigorously, he may or may not be giving proper weight to various military privileges, but the question at what point these records are necessary, should they be disclosed to other parties, and what does fair trial require is obviously a complicated balance of interest that's being played out very dramatically in this case.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk now with Richard. Richard's with us from Flagstaff, Arizona.
Good morning, Neil. Great show so far.
Thank you.
I want to echo Lenore's comments as well, some very, very prescient points that she made. My concern, and actually I'm quite appalled, that other reported subpoenas were accepted just on face value and weren't challenged. I'm the lay legal advocate at a local domestic violence shelter here in Flag, and we have licensed counselors that work with survivors of sexual assault all the time. And we're very fortunate to have an attorney who works for us pro bono. And many of his challenges involve answering to subpoenas from other sides, such as perpetrators or abusive husbands, that wish to have either their rape victims or the people that they've hurt and their files been brought out into court. So I'd just like to make a point out there that if there's other people from social service agencies that are listening, they can definitely go seek out someone to assist them in preventing these kinds of subpoenas to just go blanket through without any.
Thank you, Richard. Appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Take care.
Here's an email we got from the Reverend Linda Willie, I hope I'm getting that right, in Peabody, Kansas. As a United Methodist pastor, when people ask me about confidentiality, I tell them that our conversations are confidential unless they are going to or have harmed themselves or others. For example, if somebody tells me they have molested another person, I'm obligated to report it to the necessary officials. If they're thinking about suicide, I will do what I can to prevent it. My definition of harm is mostly physical harm. I've had a parent tell me that if their child tells me that he or she is homosexual, I have to tell the parent. In that case, I would not, thinking the parent would harm the child. Jeffrey, a lot of these questions about the clergy privilege came up in relation to alleged abuse cases.
They did indeed. And we saw in those cases that, as the email suggests, there is a crime fraud exception to many privileges. And if a clergyman is party to abuse, which could constitute a criminal offense, he or she certainly can't invoke the privilege to shield himself from scrutiny. We also saw cases there where people had reached voluntary confidentiality agreements with the church. In other words, they'd often received payments in response for promises not to talk about the abuse. But later, subpoenas issued in the course of a legitimate investigation trumped those confidentiality agreements, suggesting that none of these privileges are absolute. So this is yet another example of how the interests on both sides are balanced in most of these cases.
You're talking about the gag orders that are often placed on divorce cases, for example?
Divorce cases, absolutely, and child abuse cases involving clergy or not involving clergy. Often confidentiality is part of the deal. You get money as compensation if you promise not to discuss it, but then if the thing is later criminally prosecuted, then many of the clergy may have the information disclosed anyway.
And there are, it seems to me, have been several cases about who exactly is a clergyman and did this situation, did the person talking to the person who may or may not have been in the clergy have an expectation of confidentiality?
Absolutely, and that parallels the discussion we were just having about whether alcoholics counselors, social workers, and so forth are entitled to the therapist privilege. So deciding who's entitled to the privilege is central. If I might, that's the central question that's coming up in these journalist privilege cases. In denying the privilege of Matt Cooper and Judith Miller to protect their sources, one of the judges on the U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington said, in the age of the blog, now that every citizen with a modem is a potential journalist, it would be impossible to create a broad journalist privilege not to respond to subpoena, because then basically anyone could refuse to talk to a grand jury by claiming that they're a journalist.
And in that case, of course, you've had, many states and the District of Columbia, as a matter of fact, have shield laws that would protect journalists in exactly these circumstances, but this is a case where federal law would trump state law.
That's exactly right, and the Supreme Court held in the 1970s, I think, that there's no constitutional privilege not to talk to the press. This, interestingly, can be contrasted with Europe. Mostly in Europe, First Amendment rights, free speech rights, are protected less vigorously than in the United States, but in most European countries, I gather, journalists do have a right not to talk in response to subpoenas.
We're talking with Jeffrey Rosen about issues of confidentiality, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's get another caller on the line. This is Ellen. Ellen's calling from Amherst, Massachusetts.
Oh, thanks for having me on. My question is sort of basic. I have not been able to understand why Robert Novak is not being prosecuted, threatened with jail, when he was the one who revealed Valerie Plame's name and her undercover status, and Matthew Cooper and Judith Miller, who hadn't written about that, are being threatened with jail. I mean, I don't understand what is happening there.
Jeffrey Rosen, now that we know who Deep Throat was, this may be the biggest mystery in Washington.
Absolutely. It's a great question, and I can't quite answer it either because I don't have all the facts, but I gather, I would speculate, that either Robert Novak reached some kind of agreement where his source released him and allowed him to talk to prosecutors, as happened to a different source for Matthew Miller, Libby Lewis, who told Matt Miller that he could talk about that conversation, or else he hasn't refused to talk in the first place and has already told the special prosecutor everything that he knows. So, but I agree with the caller that it is odd that the person who actually disclosed the information is not facing jail, whereas more peripheral journalists are.
Well, just one follow-up, because I thought it was a federal crime to reveal that somebody is undercover, you know, as a CIA agent. So
I believe that's correct, yes.
And it was, and it's precisely that, the severity of that crime, that led the judges on the D.C. Circuit, the appellate court, to say that the national interest in this investigation was so high, based on secret presentations that they heard suggesting the genuine threat to the officer that was posed by the disclosure, that that made it necessary to overcome any privacy interest the journalist might have had.
Although he revealed the name, so it's so inexplicable to me.
And to everybody else, Ellen, all we can do is say, stay tuned.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you for the call. And while we're on the question of Watergate, Jeffrey Rosen, during Watergate, the use of the executive privilege got such a bad reputation. No president wanted to cite executive privilege ever again. Of course, ultimately, some of them felt that they were required to do so. Under what circumstances the president allowed privileges like that?
Well, that's absolutely right. The U.S. v. Nixon case was one in which the Supreme Court said that although executive privilege does have common law and perhaps constitutional roots, it can be overcome when there's a strong need for the information, in this case a subpoena from the special prosecutor and a separate one from Congress, and therefore President Nixon had to yield. The Nixon case was relevant during the Clinton years when Clinton tried to resist some of Ken Starr's subpoenas unsuccessfully. The Supreme Court refused to apply the privilege in that case, and just recently we saw that the president had better luck when Vice President Cheney was trying to withhold records of his energy task force, including its membership, and successfully invoked executive privilege, and therefore he doesn't have to turn over those names. So this is yet another balancing act, and different judges will strike the balance differently in different circumstances.
I wonder, do you think the phrase executive privilege after all these years has survived the stain of Watergate?
Well, the Bush White House certainly doesn't seem to be too upset about it, and it was funny to see some of the very judges on the D.C. Circuit and the Supreme Court who had been so scornful of executive privilege during the Clinton years and when Hillary Clinton invoked it to keep her records private, returned to their traditional sympathy for executive privilege, which especially conservative judges have tended to have over the years when it came to the Bushies. So I'm not making a claim of raw partisanship, but it's certainly the case that these things wax and wane depending on who the administration is.
We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we will continue our conversation with Jeffrey Rosen and with you about confidential sources and confidential conversations, who's allowed to keep what private under what circumstances. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email, TOTN@npr.org. We'll also be talking about the story of America's unluckiest admiral, Frank Jack Fletcher, and the Battle of Midway. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're wrapping up our conversation with Jeffrey Rosen of George Washington University Law School and the New Republic about confidentiality, this following cases in Colorado and here in Washington, D.C. and in Indiana involving confidentiality of rape counselors and journalists and Planned Parenthood clinics. More questions raised about what's confidential, what's privileged conversation, and what isn't. Let's get another caller on the line, and this is John. John's calling from Rockville, Maryland.
My wife works for the State Department, has for many, many years. She has a top secret clearance and is required to get a security check every 5 years. Some months ago, as she was interviewed, the investigator asked her whether she's getting psychiatric treatment, and she said yes. And he said, "What's the name of your doctor?" Now, I mentioned this to a rather prominent psychiatrist, and he was outraged. He said that she did not have to answer that kind of question. However, 2 months ago, when it came down to the crunch, and I told my wife that her secure clearance will not be renewed unless she signs a release for the psychiatrist to give information to the government investigator. And I checked with the same psychiatrist and talked to previously, and he told me, yes, the situation has changed, and right now he himself has been forced to release information on his clients because that is now what the government demands.
And was he speaking specifically about these kinds of national security information?
Yes, this has to do with people who need a clearance investigation, and the government demands that they sign a release, and mm-hmm. that's on the condition of them continuing to work.
Yeah, Jeffrey Rosen.
Very interesting and difficult situation. I guess it shows the limited scope of the privilege that the Supreme Court recognized was a privilege against the substance of therapist records in civil proceedings. So I guess if you've got a security investigation without any civil or criminal charges pending, the government can condition employment on the waiver of rights that you might be able to exercise in other circumstances. But it's a sad situation, and it also shows the great pressure, especially after 9/11, to waive privacy rights in the name of purported interest in security.
I'd like to make another comment. I checked with the American Civil Liberties Union, and after I gave them the information, they never called me back.
Hmm. John, thanks very much for the phone call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Let's see if we can get one more caller in on this, and this is Robin. Robin's with us from Reno, Nevada.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment has to do about confidentiality of medical records. This is a hot issue in my field. I'm a genetic counselor.
Oh, boy, yeah.
And there have been a couple of court cases where physicians have been found liable for not telling family members of a patient about a hereditary condition because there's a breach of their ethic, do no harm. Harm may be incurred by those family members, and if the patient doesn't tell those family members, him or herself, then judges have ruled that it's the physician's duty to make sure that family members know of their risk.
Jeffrey Rosen, and this is just going to get murkier and murkier as we learn more and more about genetics.
It is. I think this is the most fascinating frontier of the conversation that we're having. There's so much to say about it, but just very briefly, I know in England they've rejected the idea of wrongful birth cases for failure to disclose genetic defects. And they've passed statutes balancing the rights of family members to know against the rights of individual patients not to know. People have such different intuitions about where the balance should be struck in this area. And one big question will be, is this a question that the courts are going to resolve on their own? Are they going to balance these rights for us? Or will Congress and the state legislatures do a better job at striking these finely hewn decisions? But Viv, I'm so glad that was raised because we're going to have to watch this area. It's very interesting.
Robin, good luck.
Well, our feeling in my field is that society needs to be talking about these things.
Well, no question.
Thank you very much for the phone call. Appreciate it. And Jeffrey, thank you for your time today.
Thank you. It was a real pleasure.
Jeffrey Rosen, an associate professor at George Washington University Law School, legal affairs editor at The New Republic.